Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome back to Hawk Binge, your guide through the astral plane that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company of, as ever, a long-term fan, which is me, and of course, our first-time listener, which is Matt in New York. How's life, Matt?
Life is good, Andy. Thank you very much for asking, and Happy New Year to you.
And to you, yes, indeed. It doesn't seem that long ago that there I was in New York with you, potentially facing Christmas and New Year in New York if I failed my COVID test prior to the return flight.
I think actually you got away with not only the COVID flight, but the weather change, because after you left, we got the wave of a bomb cyclone which swept across the US. And the last week or two, it's been down to minus 10, and we got about 7 inches of snow on the entire city, which was quite magical for a minute until it all turns to slush and horribleness.
Yeah.
But my Husky Cross dogs really enjoyed it. They absolutely never wanted to come in as soon as I took them out for a walk, just rolling around and playing in it. There's something weird because, you know, they're cross dogs, so they're not natural huskies, but when they see the snow, there's this weird kind of primal look in their eyes, like, I remember. And so I do enjoy being out in it whenever it lands on us. But, you know, it's magical for a day.
Yeah.
And then you have a whole week of trying to deal with it. But apart from that, everything's pretty good.
It was glorious while I was there. It was like bright, sunny days. So yeah, I timed it well. Since then, it's been a couple of months since we recorded one of these. Last one we did, obviously, was with superstar guest Mr. Joe Banks. But that feels like it was years ago, because this has been an intense start for the year on this side of the pond. And how's it been for you?
Same. I've kind of, like professionally, I've gone into a position which has required a lot more investment in like time and energy, which is one of the reasons why I don't think we picked this up in January again. I kind of needed that break to reorient myself. But Christmas was fun. I'm still in New York and can't really go anywhere. So Christmas was a bit more chill for me, which was nice. I was able to get through a lot of backlog of trying to make some music and trying to listen to a whole bunch of albums I'd missed. Also, we have completely redesigned the Hawk Binge look and feel for season two, try to update it along with the 80s, which we're now covering. So that took a little bit of time as well. So there's been some kind of Hawkwind adjacent work, which hasn't actually been the recording, which has been keeping me busy as well.
Yeah, fair. For me, this explosion in the term metaverse and all that it entails has resulted in ludicrous amounts of hours and more days of working per week than there are in the week. So I've been kind of deluged by that. But at the same time, it feels like such a Hawkwindy thing. I'd love to do something with Hawkwind in that space. But yeah, so it's good to get back to it. What it has meant is, of course, that we've been listening to Levitation for somewhat longer than we would normally have to listen to these albums. But of course, it's not all that we've been listening to, is it, Matt?
It's not. And before I tell you about my first turntable pick, I wanted to thank you for my Christmas present. Aww. From you to me, which was the Levitation album, as well as a copy of Space Ritual.
You were almost right. It's Levitation and Live 79 as a double, and the other one is In Search of Space.
In Search of Space, sorry. Does it contain a logbook?
Yeah, we looked at it. You took it out, looked at it.
God damn it. I don't remember. Whoops.
It does, and it's in perfect condition, the logbook.
I'm excited all over again now. I can't believe I forgot that.
It's all right. We've got our blooper anyway.
Brilliant. It's always nice to get the first one out of the way. You know, then everything feels a lot better. For me, I guess that was one of the times when the podcast really took flight for us. I guess, you know, we had a lot to talk about. There was so much audio and visual and tactileness in that. So to have a copy of that, I feel is very special. So I just wanted to say thanks for that. I appreciate it.
You are most welcome. Hopefully that vinyl collection will grow, but grow sporadically and randomly, as Hawkwind collections should.
I have a copy of that Greasy Truckers album as well, which I got for Record Store Day. Mm. But I think it still might even be in the cellophane, as all people who collect records know is the best way to have a record collection.
Excellent. Excellent.
But speaking of, yeah, I've got two things that I've been listening to that I wanted to share with the class. One of them is maybe a little bit more predictable for us, and one of them is maybe a little less predictable. So I'll start with the stranger one. I guess for me, like any mid-30s person, pop music and I parted way quite some time ago. But there are some acts that I always feel transcend what I would refer to as the Uber ride radio playlist, you know, and one of those surprised me by being The Weeknd. The Weeknd's had some national number one record releases and they have a Super Bowl halftime show under their belt. So you might think that The Weeknd would be pretty much kind of done creatively by this point and just happy to recycle things. But his most recent album is actually this rather stirring concept album. The story of the album goes that The Weeknd has reached the end of his natural life and is now stuck in traffic on this long drive to the afterlife. And the album is what's on the radio as he slowly heads towards this white light at the end of this tunnel. So there's this really interesting idea in this already that intrigued me. And there's a radio DJ who's actually voiced by Jim Carrey, who appears every so often to mark time throughout the album. They talk about like the point of this album at the beginning, and then they keep coming in and just being like, you know, you're almost there, and just a few more tracks and eventually you'll be through the white light. It's all very soothing in a very strange kind of way, and just reflects really nicely with the way that The Weeknd is able to do this great kind of 80s sound revival stuff that kind of reminded me a little bit of the Levitation stuff that we've been listening to. So maybe that was something that was also an interesting parody there. All the songs are deliberately catered for him and his life. So there's lots of fond memories, there's notes of regret, people he'll miss, things he wish he'd done, all in that lovely bittersweet vocal that he has. So I really enjoyed that. The track which I will share is called Gasoline, and it's my favorite, I think, because the lyrics are all about the bleakness of an atheist coming to terms with their impending death, which again, for a pop act, is not the kind of thing that you'd normally expect them to talk about. But also at the end, the chorus is all about wanting to have like a Viking style funeral. If I should die comfortably tonight, wrap me up in these sheets and get the gasoline. And I'm like, that's a cool way to go.
100%. I once gave a Viking funeral to a goldfish, like a toy Viking boat, set fire to it, lots of firelighters, it went up. And I did realize then that at that point that my goldfish was having a much cooler funeral than I was going to have and was slightly jealous. But yeah, that's excellent. And funnily enough, The Weeknd comes to mind because talking about Metaverse, they are one of those bands who have done one of these concerts in a virtual world. So might actually go back and see if I can find that, having listened to you talk about them.
Cool. And then bringing it back down to more of our usual stuff that we check out, Green Lung is my next band that I wanted to share. They are one of those bands which I discovered kind of randomly when they absolutely blew up the Doom charts in 2019 with an album called Woodland Rites. For me, they came out of nowhere. And then for a month or two, you just couldn't get them off the number one spot. And I thought that was very exciting, you know, for a band to just appear like that. And when I listened to them, I could completely see why. They have such an exciting energy to them. It's quite a classic sound. Lots of pleasing chord changes, melodic riffs that keep your head nodding from the beginning of every track to the end. I really like the singer's voice, which, as I've said before, is something which normally turns me off a lot of that kind of music to listen to rather than go and see. But this guy's voice just seems to go really well with the lazy big power chords. I was going to actually put Let the Devil In as the track which I wanted to include because that's their definite hit. But they have a new album out, which is called Black Harvest on Svart Records. And there's a track on there called Leaders of the Blind, which for me has all the same exuberance and energy of Let the Devil In, but is a fresher take on that as it's their new stuff. And so I wanted to celebrate their new album and put Leaders of the Blind on to the start of shared playlist number 4. They're also playing Desert Fest New York, so I'm very excited to see them.
Yeah, and I am also flying out to see them and you. So, yeah, look forward to that one for sure. I've got a couple of things that I've been listening to. One is a Stone Cold classic that I've been listening to for decades, and the other is a incredibly recent discovery. And that first one is the first album by the Pretenders of Chrissie Hynde fame. They have a new album out as of last year called Hate for Sale, which is really good. It's actually kind of a return to this kind of thing. But that first album, anybody who's into the Pretenders knows that those first two albums really are absolutely sacred. And then tragedy struck. There were some deaths in the band. Still managed to do some good things over the next few years. And Chrissie Hynde is something of a legend and absolutely brilliant. Massive respect. But those first two albums are amazing. And the first album is as close to being a perfect album as Makes No Odds. I've picked a track, but literally I could have just randomly picked any of them equally. She has a strange way with guitar licks and guitar chords that really makes the kind of hooks of her songs stand out. And that first Pretenders album on Sire in the US, not sure in the UK, absolute genius, and has Brass in Pocket on it, which is the one that everybody seems to know. That's not the track I've picked. I've picked a track called The Phone Call. But literally, it's an album I can put on regardless of where I am, what I'm doing, and what mood I'm in, and instantly be right there. So Pretender's first album is definitely my first one. And funnily enough, I started listening to that again while I was in New York, and it's kind of been on and off since then. So I'm still kind of occasionally putting that on wherever I am. So brilliant, brilliant album. The second one I changed as of yesterday. So I had a pick, which I've had ready to be my turntable pick now for well over a month. But now I'm going to save that one for next time, because I was looking at, you know, what we were going to talk about in terms of some of the correspondence we've had and going through some posts and some Twitter picks and things like this. I saw that I posted about the fact that I'd bought a single from Discogs, which was the Psychedelic Warlords doing Sonic Attack. And on the B-side was White Hills doing a version of Be Yourself and Acid Mother's Temple doing a version of Brainstorm. And I thought, well, that is too good a connection to miss. So I bought that single and posted about it. And White Hills then followed us. And I thought, White Hills, good Lord, I haven't listened to them for a while. I've seen them live twice. Brilliant band. Kind of very much kind of fuzz, psychedelic, space rock. Absolutely brilliant, perfect band. And I've got a couple of albums. But I was just, you know, fizzing through a few things and came across an album that they did in collaboration with a band that we saw at Roadburn a few years ago called Nod, spelt with a silent G, Gnod. And we saw them, and Nod were quite aggressive. They felt like a kind of Manchester's answer to Rage Against the Machine politically, because they were quite a political band. They had an album they brought out, I think, in 2011, called Just Say No to the Psycho Right-Wing Capitalist Fascist Industrial Death Machine, which is, you know, a catchy album title right there. But actually, they're kind of a collective from Manchester of artists and musicians, and a very random thing, kind of Hawkwindy in that way. And they collaborated with White Hills on an album. I thought, well, I must listen to that. It was called Dropout 2, which suggests there's a Dropout 1 that I haven't found. But it's not in White Hills. And it's beautiful. It's this space rock, you know, with these motoric beats, very kind of shimmering guitar, it's instrumental, and it's just gorgeous. So I was listening to that last night, and I thought, well, I have to share this, because two things that we've shared that have brought up the most interaction from everybody having shared them for the Hawkbinge Sessions playlists are Samsara Blues Experiment and Geobia. And I was listening to this and thought, this would go down so well. Everybody would really find something brilliant in here. This is a fantastic album. Not necessarily representative completely, particularly of Nod, but really, really good. And also White Hills feature two people, which is Dave W. and Ego Sensation. And I quite like the name Ego Sensation. She is the bass player. She plays like a transparent bass guitar, and they are both very, very glam. Definitely check out Dropout 2 by Nod and White Hills. The track I selected is Run Around. So, yep, those are my two picks, Pretenders and Nod and White Hills.
Very cool. And we'll be looking forward to sharing that playlist in a few episodes' time when we've got it nice and full of our Hawkwind selects and the cool stuff that we have been listening to. So already building the season 2 extra bonus content, which is always fun.
Exactly. And so we've heard a lot from everybody. Obviously, it's been quite a while since we did this, a couple of months, which is, the longest gap. And in that time, lots and lots and lots of people have been in touch, way too many to really feature. A special one I must call out is God Unknown Records, who reached out to say that they were really enjoying the podcast and offered us a freebie, which is really nice, and subsequently sent me a poster. Basically, the Space Ritual album cover illustration of Stacia from Barney Bubbles, signed by the woman herself. And that's beautiful. So thanks very much to God Unknown Records. And actually, Nod and White Hills have both releases on God Unknown. So again, another little link back there. On Twitter, in amongst all of the many, many, many messages that we've had, have been a number of people who've just started to follow us on Twitter in the last couple of weeks. So I'm taking that perhaps as a sign that these people have just found us and have just started to listen as well. And if so, then welcome aboard for the ride, David Lack, Stephen Leach, Me and the Monkey, Eric Fuhrer, Romy, Caesar Eye, Chris Loves Leeds, and Bunsen Honeydew. There are more, basically, but there's a limit to how far back I can keep trawling through the Twitter to find these things. But welcome aboard all of you guys. And anybody else who has found us in the last couple of months and started to listen, I hope you enjoy catching up with season 2.
And from my point of view, I'm very gratified that the YouTube experiment that I started about halfway through season one has really started to bear some serious fruit, both in the listener amount and the comments that we get. I kind of loosely keep the Instagram involved, but I've always seen that Twitter's always been kind of our hotbed. But YouTube's been actually really active. We have currently, I think, 92 subscribers, which is amazing. And if we hit that 100 mark, then we can actually get our own vanity URL. So if you are listening and not subscribed yet, to our YouTube channel, we would really appreciate the subscription just so we can hit that 100 figure and be seen as a legitimate producer in YouTube's eyes. It gives us a few more creator tools and like we said, that vanity URL, which really helps. So this is my little start of season two plea for everyone to come and subscribe to us and make me feel happy.
And of course that will make us easier to find, right? Basically for other new people and spread the gospel of Hawkwind further and wider.
Exactly. It just gives us that nice kind of loop where as soon as we show we have this many people, YouTube take us seriously, which means we're able to get out there, which is great. And in terms of people talking to us on the platform, Don S said that that was a great way to end an excellent season. Thanks and happy levitations for the new year. So thanks very much, Don S. Happy levitations to you too, which we'll be getting to very shortly. Jones the Boat, who follows us on Twitter, mentioned that he thought there was an excellent overview of the previous podcast and the 70s album's extras. As a Hawkwind obsessive, it was fascinating and refreshing to hear these takes on music that's been so personal to him, even when he occasionally disagrees, which is absolutely fair. Great to have you, Jones the Boat, to be listening to us on Twitter and on YouTube. Darren Everton replied to us saying that Hawk Binge has become one of my three regular podcasts, which is amazing. And so thank you very much for adding us to your rotation, Darren. And said that Andy puts a lot into the preparation of this and it shows. So some appreciation for all your hard work there, Andy, which is great.
That's Respondent of the Week.
Someone who I only know as Rick replied to the most recent episode saying, thanks for the 70s Christmas special. Joe Banks as a guest star is always a special treat, and mentioned that he thought that Over the Top really once again showed Calvert's brilliant ability to write compelling lyrics and deliver them in an improvisational style, which I think is very true. And that track is very much indicative of that. And agreed with you, Andy, that Valium 10 was a worthy pick. He said the same thing that I thought, that I can always do without the dentist drill at the beginning, but then just descending into what he called 7 minutes of bounce is very true. I think it was Rick possibly that recommended ages ago that I should check out A Minor Jam Session, because he wrote that it was one of his favorite Hawkwind songs. So if that was you, Rick, then thanks very much. That was a great discovery to share. A few other people, I guess, have now realized that we're on YouTube, because I got quite a lot of comments on previous episodes. I'll just fly through some of these, but Dominic Sean McCann left a lot of comments across all of them with little opinions and memories. So thanks very much for that, Dominic. Someone who is either called Bunny, Buny or Bernie, I'm not 100% sure, said that for Space Ritual, that these are two of the best pieces of live vinyl in existence, which I think a lot of people agree with. Jason Janot kind of cropped dusted our videos with a ton of comments. The ones that caught my eye the most was that he said, Simon House means more to me in Hawkwind than Lemmy, which I would probably agree with, I think, considering the amount of times where I've said that he's absolutely saved a breakdown. Simon Grundy shared a memory that he read that Children of the Sun was put together in a few hours when the album came up a few minutes short, which is why only David Anderson and Nick Turner could be located to create it. So considering that that's a track that we talked around quite a lot and have referenced several times, for that to be something that it seems like they pulled out of thin air to make time, that's quite incredible and a great story. Simon also left a comment that started, not to be a pedant, which is the kind of thing that, again, when you read, it's a bit like no offense or something when you think, oh God, here we go. But he mentioned that I'd spelt Do-Re-Mi wrong on the YouTube clip. So to go from not to be a pedant to pointing out that I'd made a massive schoolboy error, I'm not sure if that's pedantry to say that you've spelt the album wrong. So all is forgiven. Thank you very much for the shout on that. And that has now been corrected.
It was funny. I had the same. I went from, oh, for God's sake, here we go, to, oh, fair enough then.
Yep. Carl Scott dropped in saying he's really enjoying these good work chaps. Thanks very much, Carl. Hope you're back and listening to season two. A Crooked Beat said another great Hawkwind episode for PXR 5 and said that for me, this is the best of the Hawkwind Light albums. He thinks he could make one good album from the four Light Hawkwind albums. So I guess now I'm on a mission to try and figure out what those other three are and see whether or not I agree. And Steve Bailey was one of the many people who still likes to point out that Quarks have strangeness and charm as elements. So again, thank you to everyone who still keeps reminding me of that. That is something that I will never, ever, ever forget. Steve also pointed out that John the Bog was actually a roadie for Hawkwind, and I found a interview with Nick Turner about this, who said we were in Scotland and Dick Mick, two of the roadies and a couple of girls took a corner too fast, turning the van over. They hit a car. I think the driver was killed. One of the roadies, John the Bog, had his elbow sticking out of the window, and when the van turned over, half his elbow was ground away. Me and Dell had to reclaim the van later. It was a bit of a wreck. So that suddenly brings some fresh relief to that song, that actually that was someone who they definitely lost during the days of the underground, but it seems to be, unfortunately, a self-inflicted tragedy.
Yeah, that's a grim story, but it's brilliant when people get in touch to fill in the blanks, basically, in some of the stories that we haven't known. So thanks very much for that, even if it may be a story that I might have preferred not to know.
Another Hawkwind adventure that we are now aware of. And
exactly.
Again, if it makes it into the music, then I suppose then that is fair enough. And again, that ability to go out, have adventures and talk about them is one of the great things when you're a band that tours as much as them.
Oh, absolutely. I can imagine for all the stories we know of, there are dozens and dozens that are just lost in the midst of time that would make for 10 books on their own. We got a whole lot of very long emails as well, didn't we?
We did. And I've tried to make these concise because I and you absolutely love to read them. Brevity is certainly something that we're never encumbered with on this podcast, but I'll try and make it not super long. But I just want to give a shout out to a few people. One of those is Dave Bevan, who binged the podcast while painting the outside of his house when he discovered it. So I hope that house is now a brilliant silver machine colour. He sent us a very long email with some great stories, of which I'll call out two. He said, as a teenager, I was an avid reader of Michael Moorcock, and someone said, if you like Moorcock, you should be listening to Hawkwind. And that coincided with Warrior being released. So it's my first Hawkwind album, and I will not have a word said against it. So I guess anything I said about that must have pinged off his extreme fandom armor, which again is perfectly fair enough. But again, an interesting fact that coming into Hawkwind through literature and all of the references that they grab and incorporate into their music seems, again, a very great, credible way of getting into the band, and probably gives you a better appreciation, again, of what they're doing. Even sometimes when I feel like I need to have that explained to me, that idea of coming into it from that is very cool. And his second point, which is something which actually you just hit on and isn't something that we've ever really talked about, but wanted to cover off while it was brought up, considering that we're leaving the 70s behind, is that he said, although Stacia had departed before I saw them in 1975, if you mention Hawkwind to anybody, the two things they would say would be Silver Machine and Stacia. She was so synonymous with the early band, she deserves to be at least mentioned in dispatches. So thanks for your email, Dave. We hope you got the Joe Banks book for your birthday like you hoped. Sorry, a lot of B's right in a row there. That was hard to say. But Andy, just quickly about Stacia, I don't want to get too much into it as that's kind of like a 70s thing, but yeah. To mention her in dispatches, what can we say? Because I guess she wasn't so much a band person, it's not something that we've really discussed.
Yeah, it's another one that illustrates this kind of almost commune nature of Hawkwind. Basically, there is the band writing and releasing the music, but then you have people like Michael Moorcock, Barney Bubbles, you know, at first, before he was the singer, Robert Calvert, people associated with the band who are not on the albums, but are a huge part of the band. And particularly in this case, the performance, because Stacia, and you'd have to look her up, really, I'm not going to describe Stacia, but she basically would get on stage with the band, naked most of the time, I think painted up, could be wrong about that, but that's what I've seen, and dance and be one of the dancers on the stage. And obviously when you've got this kind of incredible psychedelic music and the incredible light show that Hawkwind had, which was a core part of who they were, that just must have been an absolutely incredible sight and such a part of the performance. And she effectively was part of the touring band for some years and is obviously on the front of Space Ritual, you know, the biggest album the band ever did. And she is on the front cover of that album. So yeah, a real personality. And you do hear, certainly in interviews with people that I've seen on TV who are talking about the impact of Hawkwind on them, that that is exactly what they say. They say Stacia was a huge part of their first experience with the band, and definitely, definitely not to be forgotten, and is well written about in the Hawkwind books that we refer to. So if you have got the Joe Banks book, then you will certainly find enough there. And in the other books as well, she is definitely a part of Hawkwind history.
Maybe that's even something that we'll talk about when we do finally go back and talk about the live album some more, because I guess that would be appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we in covering the albums, we obviously don't talk about the massive, massive impact of Hawkwind on stage and the stage shows and the lights and everything else. So that is definitely a story for another time for us.
Okay, very cool. Moving on. Hello to Ian Griffiths, who wished us a great Christmas and New Year and encouraged us to keep up with the pods, which we certainly shall do. One of his notes was that he thought High Rise would have found a good home on 25 years instead of PXR5. And I kind of agree, although I think that that helped PXR5 become an album in its own right for having that key beat. Otherwise, I think PXR5 might have felt a little bit anemic. Hello to Bramwell Johnson, who listened to our PXR5 episode on a Christmas Eve stroll across his local fields, which sounds pretty awesome to me. And he actually brought up an interesting point that hadn't occurred to me. And that was, until the albums came out that Hawkwind produced, he wasn't able to hear tracks like Uncle Sam's on Mars, High Rise and Robot, because he wasn't able to see the band live. He just didn't have the opportunity. So those tracks had already gained word of mouth legendary status for those who had attended the gigs and where they'd been played. So if you only followed Hawkwind with the albums, you were almost effectively one album behind everyone for a long time. So that was an interesting idea there, the fact that they are putting so much stuff out there in the live shows and working all that out, that if you don't go and see them, you are literally missing out on that real-time vibe.
Absolutely. And again, it's another signal of how important the live side of Hawkwind is and how interesting it'll be when we get to that in 2025.
Yeah, I know. We're doing a lot of talk about how great the live albums are while being nowhere near the end of the studio. So we should probably stop infuriating people with like that. But he also said he was looking forward to the bonus extras episode and hope we'd take specific look at Urban Gorilla. And as he said, Bob Calvert's incredible Over the Top track. So we talked about Over the Top, but none of us mentioned Urban Gorilla. So I was wondering whether or not that's something maybe we should touch on really quick just to draw a line under that, which I think is the last 70s thing that we need to mention.
Absolutely. And we realized that we'd missed Urban Gorilla not long after we recorded, when we kind of looking through the bonus tracks thinking, how did none of us pick this? And we actually added it to the Spotify playlist for that, to make that 10 songs rather than 9, because of the fact that it's a bit of a glaring omission. And Urban Gorilla was the follow-up single to Silver Machine and had words, you know, I'm an urban gorilla, I make bombs in the cellar. And unfortunately, the release of that coincided with an IRA bombing campaign on the UK mainland, which caused the single to be withdrawn. But I heard them play it live a couple of times, and it is a, you know, it's a killer of a song. It's got a good hook. Again, the usual Calvert clever lyrics. And yeah, I really, really like it. And Lord knows why it escaped my attention when we were coming to put bonus tracks together. I guess it's such a famous bonus track that it doesn't feel like a bonus track or a non-album track. But there it is. Big song, not on an album.
I kind of consciously skipped it. It wasn't one of my favorites. I thought it was okay. I think for me, it feels a little bit dated now. I feel like the lyrics are a little bit incendiary, kind of literally. I like it when Hawkwind are being a little bit more clever with things like High Rise and Robot in terms of their criticism of culture. But also, I feel like that's really not fair because they haven't even got around to writing those yet. So, you know, it's not like I can't really look at where they went and then say that they were bad for doing this. It feels a bit first thought from a younger band, which I guess, given when it was made and what it was, then I think that's true. I can see it being a crowd pleaser live. I can imagine it kind of like being a reflection of the attitudes of a lot of people who would go and see Hawkwind. And it feels like this kind of maybe manifesto against the flower power ideology and a bit more like, let's take up arms and be a little bit more guerrillery about things. Because I feel like even with the Do It in the Road feels a little bit like they're kind of sending up that peace and love and being like, that's not working. We need to start doing things a little bit more militarily.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they're definitely not a flower power band and it is very direct. It's also obviously written to be a single in a way that things like you shouldn't do that, and 7x7 are quite obviously not singles if you kind of go to that other extreme. Urban Gorilla is written to be a single. It's a fairly straightforward track musically, but catchy. And as you say, when I did see them play it live, it was pretty sweet.
Moving on to the last few emails, hello to Joe Thomas, who mentioned that Joe Banks introduced him to the podcast only of 2 days ago at time of writing, and he said he's properly binged on them already. He's on his 8th episode and enjoying them immensely. So thanks very much to Joe for letting Joe know that the podcast exists. Obviously, getting him on twice got us that one listener, which I would call added value.
Absolutely. We do love the Hawk Binge Bingers.
And hello to Nick Randalls, who sent us a message saying, it might be too late, but could I request that you shoehorn a mini Live 79 podcast in before Levitation, which I'm assuming that he wrote before we squeezed in a mini Live 79 podcast before Levitation. So we hoped you find that to your liking. And he finished off the mail by mentioning that he's got a story about how he contributed some artwork to the Church of Hawkwind album and got wrongly credited as Tim. So yes, do please share that. We would love to hear it. And that for me wraps up the mailbag.
Absolutely. And we will be getting to Church of Hawkwind in only a couple of episodes' time. So yes, please do get us that information. On the subject of the written word, this, of course, marks the last time that we will be able to refer to that Joe Banks book, Hawkwind, Days of the Underground, Radical Escapism in the Age of Paranoia, because it takes us up to and including Levitation. So we will miss Joe's book for sure, in particular how Joe deep dives into the music as well as the stories. But looking ahead, I picked up another book to give us another field of reference to go alongside Ian Abrams' excellent Hawkwind Sonic Assassins book. It was mentioned in a talk that Joe gave that I went to in London, and also by a couple of people who sent us emails. And that is the book, The Saga of Hawkwind by Carol Clark, which is a pretty meaty volume of a book. And weirdly, I'd kind of known about it without having seen it or looked into it for some time. It just kind of lurked in the back of my mind. But those made me look it up. And I found this book, found that it was out of print, managed to find a good copy, which was really expensive, so it really ought to be republished. And I looked up Carol Clark and found that she had sadly died of breast cancer in 2010. But her obituary that I read in The Guardian really just endeared Carol Clark to me almost immediately. And it said this: Carol Clark, who has died of breast cancer aged 55, was one of Britain's most influential and best-loved rock writers, who spent 20 years on the music weekly Melody Maker and wrote acclaimed books on Hawkwind, The Pogues, Madonna and The Damned. She was also an irrepressibly colourful character. She swore loudly and often, smoked incessantly, drank profusely, and robustly championing outsiders and underdogs, carved out her own legend in a resolutely male-dominated era of the music industry. So welcome aboard, Carol Clark. Apologies for not having had you on board before, but we still have 24 albums to go, and I think your book probably covers 15 or 16 of those. Very much written from a journalistic point of view. As you can see, she's written on several other bands as well, but I'm definitely become a Carol Clark fan just based on that writing alone. And we have news of another book, do we not, Matt?
Yeah, we do. When we last talked to Joe, you mentioned that it would be great to have a collection of all of Barney Bubbles' work, considering that he was so imaginative and so prolific. And Joe Banks mentioned that there was a book called Reasons to be Cheerful, The Life and Work of Barney Bubbles, which has been out of print for some time. And I did have a look, and you can find them on a few bookshops, but they go for a couple of $100s. Like, I'm looking at one right now, which is $280. So I thought that that would be something that was never really going to be within our ability to acquire. But we also then discovered, or you discovered and sent to me, news that vol.com, which is Volume Publishing, are redoing a Barney Bubbles collection called A Box of Bubbles, which you can find at vol.co, and just search Barney Bubbles, you'll see it. It's a limited run of 500, which contains, as far as I can see, pretty much everything he's ever done, which I'm hoping includes the Hawkwind books, as well as illustrations, photography, and all his crazy experiments. There are currently, at time of going to podcast, 335 remaining. So if you do fancy getting yourself one of those, then grab one while they're hot.
Indeed. They are a little pricey, but I did read somewhere that there is actually going to be also the paperback edition without all of the extra bits and pieces in the box set. But hopefully that will be reasonably priced. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to receiving that. And so onward, or rather backward, to the heady days of 1980. And we're starting now to get to a period of time that I can actually kind of remember living in, because I would have been kind of starting school at these kind of times and remember some of this stuff. And some of it we've alluded to already. So to give ourselves a flavor of 1980 and the world that that was and the kind of music that's around at the time, let's have a look at a few of the albums that were released back then. One of those albums is The Age of Plastic by Buggles. I don't know if you remember Buggles, but you must surely remember Video Killed the Radio Star. And one half of Buggles was Trevor Horn, and Trevor Horn just went on to be this huge, huge figure in music in the 1980s at the kind of forefront of New Wave. He went on to work with Yes. So that's definitely feels very much like a sign of the times. Rush came out with Permanent Waves that year. We've already talked about Pretenders. That was the year for their first album. The Cure produced two albums this year, Boys Don't Cry and 17 Seconds. We've got Elvis Costello putting out Get Happy. The Selector, we get into Scar, and this was really kind of massively all over the charts, and Too Much Pressure, which is their big one. Motorhead, who could forget Ace of Spades, is 1980, while Van Halen released Women and Children First. Duke is released by Genesis, which was a huge album for them and really kind of showed their changing direction. Judas Priest produced British Steel. Iron Maiden's debut album comes out, so we're in the new wave of British heavy metal. Black Sabbath, Heaven and Hell with Ronnie James Dio. Human League produced Holiday 80. Bad Manners, more Scar, Scar and B. The Fall, two albums from then this year, Totalus Turns and Grotesque. Devo, Freedom of Choice. Paul McCartney comes out with Paul McCartney 2. And apparently he was in prison in China for a while and then kicked out of the country this year. So not sure what that was all about. Read it in passing. Peter Gabriel's massive third album comes out this year. Absolutely incredible. Roxy Music, Flesh and Blood. Toya, that really takes me back. The Blue Meaning. Big Blue Oyster Cult album, Cultosaurus Erectus, is this year, as is Queen, The Game. It's also the year that Flash Gordon is released, which they did the soundtrack for, and what a film that was. Bob Marley and the Wailers, Uprising, is 1980. Bauhaus, what a band, In the Flat Field, comes out this year. And Ultravox, who can forget Vienna? Can you remember, Matt, what kept Vienna off the top of the charts? Because Vienna only made number two.
No. Should I know this?
It was Shut Up or Your Face by Eric Dolci.
That's a callback to a previous thing, isn't it? Which I had forgotten.
It absolutely is. And it is an appalling crime against music and somehow managed to keep Vienna off top of the charts, which must have annoyed them no end. Yes, come out with Drama. Susie and the Banshees, Kaleidoscope this year. The Cars, Panorama. Black Flag, what a band they were. Jealous Again. B-52s with the female singer with the huge beehive hair. Don't you remember that? That was Wild Planet. The Dead Kennedys, Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables. David Bowie comes out with Scary Monsters this year. Ozzy Osbourne, Blizzard of Oz, his first solo album. Madness, more Scar, absolutely. The Police, Zenyatta Mondatta. Killing Joke, eponymous album this year. U2 released Boy. Japan, Gentlemen Take Polaroids. Adam and the Ants, Kings of the Wild Frontier. I had that. What an album. Yeah, I listened to it again fairly recently and expected myself to think, eh, you know, but actually that's a killer of an album. The Jam, Sound Effects, Blondie, Auto American, two albums from The Clash, Black Market Clash, and the triple album Sandinista. Super Trooper comes out from ABBA, really takes you back into the moment thinking of that. Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark with Organization. Bruce Springsteen releases The River. Remaining Light comes out from Talking Heads. The Specials, amazing band, More Specials, their second album. Simple Minds, Empires and Dance. Gary Numan releases Telecom. So really kind of that whole motoric thing really taking over and him making his presence felt. Never Forever by Kate Bush. AC/DC, Back in Black, probably a huge statement from them. Joy Division, Closer, so we're still in Joy Division era. Dexys Midnight Runners. God, how I hated Dexys Midnight Runners come out with Searching for the Young Rebel. And I think I really hated Dexys Midnight Runners because of Come On Eileen, which was a huge hit for them, not on this album. But yes, I can't even think of Dexys Midnight Runners without thinking of Come On Eileen, and that's not good. Cabaret Voltaire, Three Mantras, Magazine, the correct use of soap. The Undertones, remember them? Hypnotized. And Sugar Hill Gang come out with The Sugar Hill Gang, so bit of rap. At the same time, there are all of these, shall we say, older bands who put stuff out in 1980, just kind of to remind people that they're still around. And those people include Cliff Richard, Dolly Parton, The Sweet, Uriah Heep, The Shadows, Wishbone Ash, and of course The Stones, who are still doing that in the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and 2020s. So The Stones will appear on these lists more and more. So that is 1980. And, you know, what an incredible year for music 1980 was. Where does it leave Hawkwind? Well, Hawkwind, of course, have toured in 1979. And they've toured with a bit of a reconstituted lineup. We talked about it in our Christmas special with Joe Banks. So definitely, if you haven't heard that, it's worth dialing in to get a little bit of the background to that Live 79 album and tour. And really, the tour took place with Dave bringing back Harvey Bainbridge and Simon King, but also with Tim Blake, who is ex-Gong and an absolute keyboard wizard in the Keith Emerson, Rick Wakeman, really flamboyant kind of a style, but a proper virtuoso, and Hugh Lloyd Langton making his return to the fold after a 10-year absence. You may remember on the very first podcast that we did with the debut album, we mentioned that Hugh Lloyd Langton was guitarist on that album, that he would disappear, but that he would return and be very much a fan favorite. Hugh is another virtuoso musician, a proper full-on lead guitarist in every sense of the term. They release Live 79, and that gives them some really good tapes for which they could find a new record label because they didn't have one. And the manager manages to get them a deal with Bronze, who are also the label that Motorhead are on. And that album comes out through Bronze and makes number 15 on the chart. So it's their biggest for a number of years. And obviously, therefore, the Hawkwind public are really taking on board this slightly more heavy and aggressive side of Hawkwind and a move away slightly from that new wave of their charisma years. And that's being very, very successful. So they've put that out. So now they are going to record an album. And at this point, something interesting happens. And that is that Simon King, the drummer, who we all love, but he's having a few problems, according to Dave Brock. He is taking some bad drugs, which basically means heroin. He's struggling a bit, and he's not really doing it in the studio. So they're left without a drummer. They're recording the album, and an idea comes up from Marion Lloyd Langton, Hugh's wife, who is working as the press officer for one Ginger Baker. And Ginger is between bands because one of his many, many bands has fallen apart, which is definitely part of the Ginger Baker story. And he comes in to take over the drum stall and record the album. They had to pay him something like double or triple the daily rates to get him in to do it. But he recorded the album in a third of the time that it would have taken anybody else. So tracks on this album that Simon was really struggling with, Ginger Baker sits down and just basically just knocks it out in a matter of minutes. And he is one of the true absolute legends of drumming. And also a true legend of being a really difficult human being to work with and to be around. His legend kind of goes off in those two directions. Famously difficult, largely insulting to pretty much everyone he ever played with. Even those people who he's closest to, he was pretty horrible to. There is a documentary about Ginger Baker produced in the 2010 or 11, somewhere around there, called Beware of Mr. Baker. And that basically tells you all you need to know. At one point, he actually attacks the documentary maker with his cane, despite the fact that he was fully being part of this documentary. So Ginger Baker. I actually had the privilege, really, of seeing him play only 4 or 5 years before he died. So not too long ago, he played at Nell's Jazz and Blues Bar in London. He put a band together to play just acoustic jazz. mainly because he'd run out of money and was going back out again. He was never someone who would do an interview and go, well, I couldn't stay away from the music. You know, it's all about the music. They would just go, why are you doing this again, Mr. Baker? And he would go, I need the money, which I always thought was quite funny. But he was so frail when he played that he had to be escorted to the drum stool by several people. But then he would sit at the drum stool and you'd reach the point where he was going to play a bit of a solo. And suddenly it was more like he was 22, not 82. It was absolutely mesmerizing. The man was a genius. There's no way around it. Whatever you think of him as a person, you do, I think, have to try not to allow that to color what you think of his ability behind the kit, because it was absolutely fabulous. And obviously there's no power there anymore, but just the technique. And he made the drum sound really loud and tribal and rhythmic, just with the technique that he had. And it was fabulous to see him play. And I do think that he is all over Levitation. But suddenly in Hawkwind, you then have three out and out virtuoso musicians. And that does very much change what happens. Imagine, you know, you have your five-a-side football team and suddenly three of your mates have left and been replaced by Maradona, Zidane and Lionel Messi. It's interesting the effect of Ginger Baker coming in has. In this little excerpt from Carol Clarke's book, The Saga of Hawkwind, this is Dave Brock's feelings about Ginger Baker coming on board. And I quote, Dave Brock remembers the excitement surrounding the arrival of the notoriously explosive Baker. We thought, cor blimey, here we are with a world-class famous drummer. He was all right, actually. He's another Leo. I'm one. Chris is one. Simon King's one. Ginger was a professional musician and a fantastic drummer. Here I am playing with Ginger Baker. What a fantastic thing to happen. And Marion Lloyd-Langton actually said that Ginger always said that apart from the Blind Faith LP, Levitation was one of his favourite albums of his whole career. She goes on to say, former Melody Maker journalist Chris Charlesworth says today, I do remember the astonishment that greeted the news that Ginger Baker joined them. It was a bit like Ringo joining the Suite, though I suppose Baker's wayward lifestyle was not incompatible with Hawkwind's. So you can see that Ginger Baker is not just a legend now. He was a legend in 1980, and you can tell that there's Dave Brock's response to having Ginger Baker in the band. So that is the lineup that goes into the studio to record Levitation. And an interesting thing is that Bronze owned the Roundhouse studio in London, which was one of the first to be fully digitally equipped. And the album, therefore, is one of the first albums to be recorded fully digitally. And Ian Abrams' book, Sonic Assassins, says this. The album's production values were far in advance of anything previously committed to vinyl by Hawkwind. This is a headphones album, stated the back cover. Bronze informed me that this was the best Hawkwind album ever, wrote Malcolm Dome, who, of course, recently passed away, so RIP Malcolm Dome. Whilst he considered this somewhat overstated, Dome heard a return to the style of the early 70s, blistering sci-fi imagery as an angry searchlight, particularly praising the agoraphobic wilderness of Motorway City and the desolate synthesizers of the J.G. Ballard-esque Dust of Time. Dome rated Levitation as an album of the year. So clearly this album went down very well. It has this digitally recorded quality to it and the first of its kind. So that's Hawkwind being pioneering again. It manages to make number 21 in the charts. So again, a really high level entry for Hawkwind, particularly given that those previous four albums on Charisma were slipping further and further down the charts in the 40s and 50s. And obviously this is really Hawkwind's first album properly recorded since 25 years, because obviously we know PXR5 was put together with recordings before. So that's what happens. In the aftermath, obviously, it's all change again. Ginger Baker leaves the band because he is who he is and falls out with everybody. And in the end, he falls out particularly with Harvey Bainbridge, who's playing the bass. And I love this quote. This is again in Ian Abrams' book. Baker later informed the music press that the world's worst bass player has sacked the world's best drummer. So I love that quote for so many reasons. It tells you so much about Ginger Baker. But he goes. Tim Blake also leaves during the tour after this album. This is Hawkwind. Why would you expect anything different? So again, this is an era of one, this album really representing. And obviously it's also the first and last studio album that they do for Bronze. So don't get too attached to what you're listening to, Matt, because again, it's fairly fleeting and the next album signals in a new era again. And with that, let us hear Matt's hot take of Levitation.
It's interesting to hear from what you just said that Dave Brock was really interested in Ginger Baker, because I feel like Dave Brock doesn't normally have a nice thing eventually to say about anyone. So to hear both kind of Dave Brock and Harvey Bainbridge and, you know, the existing old school Hawkwind band members be kind of starstruck by other musicians feels like that's a change in Hawkwind a little bit. What I mean by that is that idea that Hawkwind bringing in musicians still means that there's that kind of like plucky underdog feel, you know, by like the fact that they think that they're bringing in people that are better than them, the fact that they even made a joke about the world's worst bassist and that kind of thing. You know, they've always been very self-deprecating about their abilities, but they have obviously got better. But in this album, they're bringing in people who are just provably good.
That world's worst bassist thing, Ginger Baker said that. That's not Hawkwind making a joke. That's Ginger Baker slagging them off.
Sure, but that's Harvey Bainbridge just kind of owning it, I feel.
Oh, okay.
My point is that, you know, they've always been very like, I can't play the right notes in the right order. Or like, you know, look at this person. He can come in and play the right notes and in the right order. And he knows where middle C is on the piano. You know, they're always very self-deprecating a bit in terms of their abilities. So the fact that they brought all these people in now does change the feeling of the album quite a lot to me, actually. I feel like there is both something familiar and fresh in this to listen to. Again, I think I always say this, but whenever there's a new album, given everything that happens at the end of every album, I do always wonder what I'm going to be faced with. But this one for me has a lot of exuberance and a lot of energy in it compared with the arguably more sluggish PXR5. I feel like this one has a great sound throughout. It really does feel like some care was put into the mix and the arrangement and the recording, which, again, I have definitely said from very old Hawkwind albums that I've never really been a fan of how they sound. This one just sounds pristine. It feels like Stephen Wilson could have got his hands on this one. For me, it sounds less spacey and languid compared to something like 25 Years or PXR5. You know, this one feels more like Do Re Mi in terms of the arrangements and how the instruments are prioritized and the more kind of rock forward feel, where the other ones, they've been a bit more competitive. There'd been more things noticed about societies and strange thought exercises is about going into free fall and that kind of thing. I think this album is much less story-led. There's a lot more musical ideas in this than any of the other albums. And by that, I mean like a riff that's constructed that tells a story musically rather than the lyrics necessarily putting an idea out there that they then explore. And I wonder if that's because they feel like they now can do that because they have people who can play the instruments properly. You know, I feel like some of the stuff that we've heard, the music has been fine, that it's been led with an excerpt or a quote or a book that they read or an idea that they had or opinion that they want to share. You know, it was much more thought forward, where I feel like this is much more music forward. So it definitely feels like Hawkwind hired someone who likes solos, because this album has a lot of those in them, you know, but the interplays between all the instrumentation are very pleasing. If anything, I don't want to say it's disappointing, but it's almost so good that it's less what I sometimes like about Hawkwind, you know, the plucky kind of underdog vibes where they have an idea that they want to share and they can just about play it well enough for you to care about it, is gone and has been swapped out for people who actually have sonic thoughts and do them really well, but in so doing, kind of put them up with other sonically rich bands. And when you talked about all the other bands that are playing in the same space in the 80s, you know, I just think about, you know, like amazing bands to me that I've picked up from that, you know, like Queen and Yes and Bowie and that kind of thing. Like, when you try and elevate yourself up to their level of sonic ideas, they're already there and they're doing interesting things as well. So you do slightly lose your outsider status. So this album is both interesting in its evolution, but also not risky, but it's just a different way of evaluating the band, I guess. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like all my notes on this were much less about really the ideas and the poetry and that kind of thing, and much more about like, oh, it's interesting that this fill happened here and that. And so it was much more a critique or an analysis of the music, where, you know, not that we haven't done that before, but normally it was in service of the larger thought. And I feel like this for me is the most quote unquote album like thing that they have produced ever.
I would totally agree. It's interesting in taking that five-a-side team thing and dropping in the kind of Galacticos into it. We've been tracing the development of a band and obviously the myriad of people who've been in and out of that band and how they brought something new and whatever, and kind of tracing this journey. And suddenly you've got an album crafted where three of the lead musicians in it are Galacticos of what they do. And suddenly that journey just suddenly reaches a massive peak. I don't know where you move on from that if you want to do something else. They don't really have to, because obviously the lineup right. is completely different next time round. This is the only Galactico lineup that Hawkwind have. So it's a bit of a one-off. And it's a bit of a one-off album. To me, Hawkwind
right.
seem to have eras of three or four albums that kind of fit together. Those early UA albums and then the Charisma albums we're about to go into after this, an RCA label set of albums where they're kind of following a bit of a theme. This album just sticks out all on its own as being like a finished piece of an album. And I went through an interesting journey with it when we were re-listening to it. It wasn't one of the first wave of albums, the first three or four albums that I got, but I picked it up fairly early and it didn't stick with me early on, and I've come back to it a few times. There's a track or two on it that from the minute I heard them, they would be on any Best of Hawkwind compilation I would put together. But the album as a whole took a while. So it was interesting coming back to it for the purpose of what we're doing and listening to it solidly for a couple of months, you know, at least a playthrough once a day. And, you know, finding a new place where I sit with it was a really interesting journey for me to take. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting. I do think this is almost the reverse of the Calvert years in terms of exactly what you're saying. The conversation we're about to have is going to be almost entirely about the music. And with Calvert in his position in the band, most of our conversation was about the story and the words in the concepts. So that's an interesting one for sure that we're about to dive into. So let's dive into it. Matt, this album begins with the title track, Levitation.
It does. And I feel like if you are going to introduce yourself with a whole new bunch of people in your band, then Levitation is certainly a way to do it. It does not mess about, does it? First track of the 80s, we're off to a flying start. Even the very first time I listened to this, I'd barely registered the track had started before it just bangs through its intro and just slams into the main part of the track. You know, it's like everyone who can play an instrument is playing them at once. You don't have Dave Brock singing so much as shouting through this. And I feel like that becomes a recurring theme. I almost feel like he has to shout in order to keep up with the intensity of everyone else. You know, he feels like he's a little bit further away from the microphone and just yelling into the stage. And if you're going to try to keep up with this level of exuberance, you need to do that yourself in your vocals. So I feel like him doing this Lord of Lighty yelly thing is a good way of doing that. So I actually think that works quite well. But the fact that it just happens so quickly is very much just trying to like smash you out of any revere that you were in and just grabs you by the lapels and shakes you around a bit. So, you know, you're off to a very intense start. I don't know about you. I always feel thrown off by this track for two reasons. First, because it goes from the intro into the main bit so quickly. But also, I feel like it's a bar off. I count like four bars and then the fill and then the track. I don't know whose idea that was, but for me, I'm immediately off time. And I was wondering if that was an idea on purpose to, again, make you feel like not only do you have to recalibrate yourself to the time, but you have to recalibrate yourself to everything that's just been thrown at you. So I'm assuming, given, you know, someone like Ginger who's on there, that must have been a conscious decision, but it was a strange one for me to deal with immediately.
I can imagine it being something that the band could only do as brilliantly as they could do because of him being on board. I think it expanded the realm of what they were able to do for sure. I actually think, funnily enough, the beat in this and across the album feels thoroughly modern. This might get me into trouble as a very strange thing to say, but it's a very disco bass drum beat. It's a pounding bass beat, not in a Kraftwerk vibe, but in a disco vibe. It reminds me of when I saw a documentary about The Wall by Pink Floyd, and they were talking about Another Brick in the Wall. And Another Brick in the Wall's beat is a disco beat, and it comes up because the producer actually went to a disco in Paris and came back and went, you know, you should try this. And what Ginger is doing, obviously he's got all the fills and things going on top, but he's keeping a very, very solid beat in this, as he does throughout the album. It's a very modern beat.
That also works with techno as well, that idea that you can kind of play with time signatures and things, so long as you always reset on the eight and you have two things, normally a kick and a snare, to ground it, then you can do whatever you want. Like Alteca, for example, are a great example of that, where like they'll go absolutely crazy, but they'll keep that snare on the two and the four, just so you can understand where things are. You know, that was obviously later abused by people like Aphex Twin and Squarepusher. But right now, I feel like with this time, this is a right time to be able to be experimental, but keep it to that kind of feeling. And again, there's a lot of head nodding in this album, and there's a lot of like shoulder movement for me when I listen to it. And I think it is because of that feeling of a steady, danceable beat. So I do feel like that was very intentional, for sure.
Absolutely. And I found that I've enjoyed this track coming back to the album now after some time of not having heard it much more. It grabbed me much more. First time round, the weirder, more spacey elements of the album were what I gravitated towards. And the more song-oriented stuff on the album was what left me a little behind. And obviously that's dominant in the first half of side one, which is why I don't think I'd connected with this album quite as powerfully first time round. But definitely coming back to it and remembering that I hadn't really connected to it, and then it starts and I found myself very much drawn into it. And they played it in the last gig, and it was really good, basically. And it was obviously, that was just before I then started listening to the album to prep for this, back in kind of, you know, in October, November. I was very into it. It drew me right in. Funny enough, the first couple of bars, while they're kind of shuffling along and building up ahead of steam before they really kick in, it reminded me of the opening of Deep Purple's Highway Star, which does a similar thing, literally for about 10 seconds, if that. But yeah, it was funny that stuck in my head. But yeah, a very strong start. And as you say, this is the powerful edge of Dave's voice. It's not the folky kind of a voice that we've heard Dave use in the past. And it's the first full-on Dave as the sole singer of the band we've had for a while. So yeah, a powerful start. And I think his voice is good for this kind of thing, for sure.
It feels like he's inspired by who he's around. This feels like he's working hard to keep up with good people. And I feel like that's actually been a good thing for him. You know, the whole track feels a little bit like a sampler for all the artists in it. They all get their say in this track, especially when you hit the breakdown. That breakdown goes for a very long time, but it's a very intense and very interesting breakdown, you know, where everyone gets a go. It reminds me of PXR5 in that way, where it felt like there was this baton pass where everyone was like, oh my go, oh my go, oh my go. This has the same thing where you then have that interplay between like the lead guitar and then the strum guitar, and they're playing off each other, and then you bring in like the synth, and then you bring in everything else, and then the drums come back in. So I do feel like they've got this quite like, let me introduce the band sonically through the whole breakdown before we break back out again. So I do like this track as a way of getting you into it. I think that starting as quickly as it is, obviously is intentional. It does feel like it's supposed to be this kind of like, we're here and we're going to come at you. You know, this is much faster than anything I've heard them really do in the last few albums. And it just feels like Hawkwind are throwing all of its toys out of its toolbox at once and just, you know, batter the listener into submission with this new musical direction. But again, like you said, this solid groove through the whole thing. Even like halfway through the breakdown, I think there's Dave Brock doing this kind of added little bit of human percussion, which for me takes me all the way back to the Hawkwind album, like Hawkwind album one, where they were doing a lot of more of those kind of breathy loops over things. So I feel like there's a little bit of looking back, but there is this looking forward, and together this is Hawkwind trying to figure out what that means for them.
It's a real banger. And as the first album of a reborn Hawkwind, if you like, as a relaunch, and you've kind of go out there and hit them in the face, and Levitation absolutely does that.
Notably, putting the title track on the first track is something that which they've not really done before, which is interesting because that's, again, more predictable, I feel, as an album. Like, they're almost trying to arrange this more like you would expect an album to go. I actually, as a first track for Hawkwind, it is a good one for me. It's also, I guess, in a way, one of the more spacey or surreally kind of things. You know, but very light, you know, like Psi-Power was much more Hawkwindian in the way of like, I can read people's minds, but also it drives me insane. And, you know, I'm trying to hide it, but also they know, and experiments and all that kind of stuff. This is very much just someone kind of singing about the fact I can float around a bit. There's no consequence to it so much. There's no real, like, even, wow, this is incredible. There's that idea of like, yeah, I could teach you and it's now or never. So maybe there's a little bit of sinisterness in it, but you know, on the whole, it's not super exuberant about the content. It's not super dystopian or anything. It's just kind of there. And I do feel like that's something which surprised me, but also I feel like became a bit more of a departure in this album, that they're not so much sticking with that kind of like X-Files-y sci-fi stuff as we had before. And they've got it out here, but a lot of the other content is much less that. So I feel like the topics that they're going with are different, and in a way, and then more in service of the actual music again. Like, you know, they don't really have the space to tell a big story because they've got all these musicians who want the spotlight.
Which also tells you just how much of those concepts and ideas came from Robert Calvert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can imagine him coming in with the lyrics, with the concept, with the story, and then them building music around it. Whereas now they seem to be writing songs and then putting lyrics to it. Which is a very different way round. And Dave's lyrics are perfectly serviceable and they're pretty cool, but no one writes like Robert Calvert in any band, let alone Hawkwind. So it's probably good for them to move in a slightly different direction if you don't have Bob, than trying to do what Bob does, but not as well as Bob does it. That then takes us to track two, which is Motorway City.
Which I think is the track which turned me onto the Weekend track that I wanted to share for the turntable playlist, because I feel like this track is more familiar, I guess. This one feels more like it could have been maybe at home on a 25 Years or a PXR5 for me. The tempo has dropped significantly, I feel. It's really nice. I really like it. It feels like a neon-drenched trucking song. I could feel this being in an 80s film somehow, of someone who is just going down like a very wide open West Coast highway, probably at night. I can see some palm trees. I can see some diner signs. It reminded me of Outrun, weirdly, that video game from like way back when, that idea of just like, you know, open road. I think they normally have like, you know, top down Ferraris and stuff. So either way, but that idea of an open road anthem for me, it makes perfect sense here. It's got a solid groove. It's got this backbone of fuzz, which supports this more kind of whimsical lead. And this for me is one of the first times where I really felt like the interplay of the musicians themselves were the idea. There's the three note lead, and then there's a part when the guitar doesn't change, but the drums break down with the notes. And when that first happened, I was just like, yes, that's just good. It wasn't the vocal, it wasn't the idea. I mean, like, the vocals are perfectly fine, but it is, like you said, a little bit like I'm describing someone going on a journey. But it's the interplay between the musical elements, which are just very pleasing. And I could feel myself air drumming with some of it. There are these little flourishes and these little touches, which I don't really feel like we've heard before, which are very good.
This is an interesting one because I never really liked Motorway City. It crops up on another album. They play it live. Obviously, it's on Live 79. And it was on an EP called Independent Days, which is where I got Valium 10 from. And I was always a little bit meh to Motorway City. I definitely like it a lot more now than I did. It's probably my least favorite track on the album, but that's not saying that I don't like it. It does a really good job. It has those nice flourishes that you say, and I definitely, when I heard it, I was expecting to go, nah, and actually I was quite happy with it. There's a nice point where the adrenaline kicks in and it feels like it's got a bit of a buzz to it and a bit of energy to it. And I enjoyed it much more than I had in the past, for sure. So definitely an improvement over where I stood with this track back in the day.
Mm. I feel like this track suffers a little bit from what we talked about in the idea of it being good, is that if I'd listened to this out of context and you told me it was a Hawkwind track, I would have been very surprised. You know, it's not what I expect from them. It's a perfectly good, very well arranged, very nicely done, well executed song. But again, is that what I look for in Hawkwind? Not all the time. I look for a sense of a struggle, a sense of euphoria, an interesting story. So this is perfectly fine, but it is, because of its fineness, kind of melts into my brain's pigeonholing of just a song that exists. It doesn't do what a lot of Hawkwind tracks do, which is make you want to listen to it. It's not as arresting, nowhere near as like the first track, for example.
No, agreed. It's very straightforward as tracks go. Basically, there aren't really any great surprises in it, I think, was where I was at with it.
Yeah, it's quite soothing in a way, which I haven't really felt Hawkwind do before. Even this kind of call and response at the beginning where you have a vocal and then the guitar plays the melody back, it reminds me of Elton John's Are You Ready for Love? Just that kind of, I don't hear that often, but that's actually more disco-y again in a way, that idea of someone singing and then getting an instrumental response. So I've never heard that from Hawkwind before. I would quite happily never hear it again from them, but it was just weird to hear it. But it fits with the track if that's what they're trying to go for. Yeah. You know, this idea of just slow progression, we're not carrying an atom bomb, we're not on a road which is filled with giant scorpions or anything like that. We're just on a road and we're going somewhere. You know, like I said, it's got that Outrun feeling of we're just here for a drive. You know, you could have made this track today in a totally non-ironic homage to the early 80s and not been called out for it in any way. It would have been absolutely fine.
Yeah, that's a very good call.
It feels more of a time than maybe I've ever really heard Hawkwind be either, especially that lead guitar sound, that kind of like howling, that just feels very 80s as well. It's done really nicely, but again, it's one of the first times I've really heard guitar sound like a time with Hawkwind. I mean, like the big strummy guitars, which I really like from them, for me, they're not so easy to place because I could hear Opeth do that today and I would still feel like that's a great timeless sound. But that howling guitar sound, very electric, very high register, that feels like that becomes a rock staple for a while. And it's the first time I think I've really heard Hawkwind incorporate something like that. But I can imagine a virtuoso musician being like, no, this is how we sound now and we're doing it. When you have these kind of musicians, they want to sound as timely as possible because they're chasing their own voice artistically and musically. And I feel like a lot of that comes in here where you feel like you brought in some guests and they've all got their own sound. And where before you'd have that miasma feeling where, like, you know, Hawkwind are just trying to like, yeah, we've got a saxophone and a radiologist and someone else, and we're all just going to figure out what this means. And it's squadged together to make something more Hawkwind sounding in that kind of fuzz where it all comes together. This feels more separate. And in so doing, each musician has their own voice and it sounds like there's a call and response and an interplay, but they're not compressed in the same way. And it's that compression that normally makes Hawkwind sound more unique.
I completely agree. It's interesting in hearing you talk about the different voices and the separation and the kind of the way that goes around. It's actually what would apply to most kind of classic jazz bands. It's kind of exactly that. They each have their own spot and they each get featured in different ways. So yes, good breakdown of that one, and definitely more to it than meets the eye, more to it than met these eyes back in the day anyway. And that takes us to an interesting second half of side one, which is Psychosis and World of Tears. And although they are down there as separate tracks, I don't know about you, but I've always thought of Psychosis as an extended introduction to World of Tears. So why don't we do those two things in one hit?
Makes sense. For me, halfway through Psychosis is the start of World of Tears.
Yes.
This track feels like a track which is two tracks. Yeah, this part of the album makes me feel like of all the great musicians that Hawkwind have got, they still can't arrange worth a damn to really make me be happy. The fade out of Motorway City and the fade in of Psychosis is too long. There's definitely dead air there. I've been brilliantly assaulted by Levitation. I've had this nice ride in Motorway City and then it fades and then there's nothing for a bit and I'm kind of looking for something. And then you start to get the feeling of the plane or spacecraft or whatever effects. You then get the radio voice and the alarm sound that suddenly appears. It's really far back in the mix, so it doesn't feel like it brings in that feeling of tension or anything. So it feels just more like this kind of sonic bed for something that doesn't then really do much. So yeah, for me, this is just a massive loss of energy for at least a minute. And then it kind of cuts out halfway through and starts to become the intro for World of Tears. I completely agree. So it skirts around the idea of being another Hawkwind-style non-track for me, but also tries and fails to connect the two big tracks, and it finds itself getting lost in between. So, yeah, calling it its own track is just that kind of thing that Hawkwind do again still, that maybe was indulgent to whoever was playing the synths at the time. I would have put this at the beginning to maybe get some kind of like theme in your head before you crash into the track. To put it again halfway through the first side feels like you're trying to start to do something and then throw it away and doesn't do much for me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all of that, particularly the dead air part. Always, if I'm streaming it walking on the road, I pull out my phone to see if I've still got a connection or something like that. There's at least 15 seconds too much space between one and the other, which irritates me every time I hear it. There are quite a lot of these to come in the forthcoming albums. You know how rap albums went through a phase of doing the thing where in between the tracks, there would be the tuning of the radio to link tracks together? These little kind of interstitial pieces, Hawking do a number of them. I quite like them for atmosphere, but it starts too late and it doesn't really do enough. I just wish they'd called the whole thing World of Tears and gone with it from there. But obviously they were written by two different people, but really one is just an intro for the other. And as an introduction for World of Tears, I'm quite happy with it.
The World of Tears intro part is really nice. By the time World of Tears comes in, you've started to get this interesting build, and then you get that great bubbly, moogy, synthy bass line, which immediately just has that great feeling of big, like, choppy tension through the whole thing. It just sounds really, really great. You've got these kind of metallic-y sounds at the top, which start to build this feeling, which feels a bit more familiar Hawkwind stuff to me, the kind of stuff that I like. And this is really the first instrumental track on the album, but it's a very secure one. The people playing the instruments are treating the music like a language rather than that idea of the vocals leading the thing, like we said before. It's the first time that Hawkwind have really led with this solid riff. It's quite a complex riff. It actually goes over several bars to establish itself before people start playing with it. It reminded me a way of Opa-Locka in the way that the drums are keeping a very solid beat, but also a very animated one. And that was a time when they had two drummers and that song was written by the drummers. So the idea that Ginger Baker being able to do the job of two drummers in one here and just keep the whole track kicking along is really, really nice. I like the way this starts. I like the sound of it. I like the intelligence of the riff. They're obviously inspired by something, World of Tears. I'm assuming, again, that's either a book or a poem or something, maybe.
Yeah, it's a book by Philip Jose Farmer.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And again, it's exactly the kind of thing which I look for in Hawkwind. I'm assuming that World of Tears spelt like a cake and maybe World of Tears spelt like crying is an idea, because this does feel like there are sinister parts of it. This is the first time where you've got the idea that there could be some dystopian vibe. The idea of multidimensionality, the idea of potential sadness and strife in all this, a little bit of tension. This for me is a really nicely done instrumental in an Opa-Locka-y Spiral Galaxy kind of way, which I really like, despite the fact it's got this annoying intro to it, which the track works very hard to apologize for and does.
Yeah, fair. This is actually one of my favorite Hawkwind tracks of all time. I loved it when I first heard it. And when I came back to it, it made me so happy. Interestingly, I'd forgotten completely the massive connection between this and a track by Fleetwood Mac in their Peter Green era called Oh Well, which if you heard it, you would absolutely know it. It's one of those really famous tracks. But just knowing the title, it might not take you there. And a lot of people go, oh, it's Hawkwind doing that track. When you hear that track, for the first couple of minutes, you'd go, this has nothing to do with it. Then it kicks in, and then you go, oh, that's World of Tears. But the Fleetwood Mac thing lasts for a few bars and then kicks in somewhere else. So if this was done consciously, and who knows if it was or not, whoever came up with this riff, nicking a few bars out of that Fleetwood Mac song, which is completely different in tone and feel, and going and making the complete track out of it. So it's definitely not one where I would say anything about it in an accusatory tone. But the riff is strikingly similar in those few bars. But as I say, Fleetwood Mac goes somewhere very, very different with it.
That's interesting. It's almost like the rock version of sampling then. If it was taken, for example, with someone going, oh, that little bit, I could do something with that, and being inspired by it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like taking a cutting from a plant and growing a new tree.
Exactly. And, you know, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. It would be wrong of me not to reference it, given how often that comes up. But I love this track. And funny enough, when I was first listening to this album, I had no idea who Ginger Baker was. You know, we're talking about me being 15 or whatever. But the thing that drew me to this track was the drumming. And to your point about what Baker is doing, keeping that beat going, but actually going round the kit in a very animated way. I've recognized why I love that so much. And that's because when he goes around the kit on each cycle, he does it very differently. It's the same pattern, but he executes it completely differently every time he goes around. It reminds me of an interview with Ringo Starr where he pointed out that when he's playing a Beatles track, the fill is different every time. And if they do another cut of the track. He can't do it the same way again. He does it completely differently again and again and again. So it's not one repetitive thing that's happening. It's subtly different every time he's going around the kit. And I love that. And I think it really powers the track and keeps the track, to use your word, which is perfectly put, very animated. And also Hugh's guitar, although it's obviously it's prominent, it's the lead instrument, it's quite understated in terms of how much technical wizardry is being employed. Hugh can go two ways. He can be very Eddie Van Halen. He can also be extremely musical. And I love the extremely musical side. I always equate that with Steve Hackett from Genesis, where Steve Hackett's guitar work was not a solo. It was part of the composition of the song. It's not just Steve Hackett plays a blazing guitar solo in these bars. And I love that about what Steve does with Genesis. And I love that about what Hugh is doing on this track. Even when he breaks out into the solo, he doesn't just go all out with it. He keeps very much in tone and serves the track. So yeah, I absolutely love this track. And was very happy to find that I loved it as much now as I did when I was playing it regularly. And would always, even if I wasn't listening to the album, would pull this track out to be on, you know, mixtapes and things like that back in the day when we were doing mixtapes.
And it finishes as well.
Yes, it does finish. Yep. It doesn't just fade out. It comes to a very satisfying conclusion.
Which I feel like it needed. You know, yes. I feel like this track, if it had faded, would have been way less good. And I feel like the drumming going around, like you said, and changing, you don't always feel like a drum is a instrument. Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes you feel like it's a very different thing because it's the rhythmic tool where everything else is melodic. When you hear something like this going round, you realize how much a drum pattern can really influence a track compared to even something like Levitation, which it's there and it's really giving you the groove. Once you hear it, you're kind of listening to everything else. This track, like Opa Loca for me, is like they've given the drums room to breathe and establish themselves.
Yeah, very much so. Couldn't agree more with that. So we do something very Hawkwindy. We flip the album over, and halfway through the album, we have a track called Prelude, which itself is actually an intro, really, to Who's Going to Win the War. But speak about Prelude.
When I first saw the track list, the fact they had a track called Prelude, which wasn't very long, which then goes into Who's Going to Win the War, which we'd already talked about for our bonus track picks, I assumed that Hawkwind must be very happy with Who's Going to Win the War if they call the track before it Prelude. So despite its kind of dumb name, it is in the same way that Psychosis is kind of an intro for World of Tears. So I wrote Space Dolphins ? In my notes. Because that's what I hear when I listen to this. It's better than Psychosis, for sure. It's quite nice, actually, as a thing. But yeah, again, is it a track? I don't know. I feel like it's more of an intro to Who's Going to Win the War, because when you get to the actual baseline establishment of Who's Going to Win the War, that's when this track definitely is over, but you've gone somewhere with it. So I just see it as a way of introduction on the other side of the record, which works perfectly fine. Could you have just made Who's Going to Win the War a little bit longer, considering it's not particularly long for a Hawkwind track, and made this like a 6-minute track? Probably. Did you want to not do that? Fine. Am I going to keep answering and asking my own questions? Yes. I don't know what else to do with this. It's not really a thing. So yeah, I'd rather talk about Who's Going to Win the War.
So let's do that. Now, as you said, we actually spoke about Who's Going to Win the War on the end of season special with Joe Banks, because Joe picked a different version of Who's Going to Win the War from a kind of a rarities collection. But it obviously is a track that really connects with Joe. So here is what Joe says about Who's Going to Win the War. It segues into Who's Going to Win the War, Bainbridge's melancholic bass riff harking back to the controlled but uneasy sound of Hawklords. While the 79 Rockfield take on the song was angry and bombastic, here it is much more somber, the sensitivity of the music counterpointing the bleakness of Brock's lyrics. Lonely fingers waiting, shadows on the hill, looking into valleys where everything is still, only death is lurking, the creeping sickness waits. The secret Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the imminent arrival of US cruise missiles into the UK had Cold War temperatures rising again. So these words are timely and chillingly effective.
I wasn't fully aware of that historical context for this, but also I feel like this is a timeless subject that Hawkwind are returning to. I was waiting for a track that kept the spirit of 25 years in PXR 5 alive, and I found it in Who's Going to Win the War. The bass line carries the track really well. It sounds ponderous. Without knowing the lyrics even, it sounds like you're wandering through something. It has that feeling like you're going on a journey, but nowhere near at the speed of something like Motorway City. It's definitely the idea that you're on foot and possibly the ground is not particularly hospitable to your journey. It has this very somber feeling. I got the idea of darkness and mist and trees without leaves and all that kind of feeling from it. Before the lyrics had ever kicked in the first time I listened to it, I thought this is wonderfully atmospheric and very down. It has this slightly high rise feel to it for me in the way that the music works. Again, Brock's singing is more of a shouty howl, which works really well again with this, because when he's not close to the microphone and you hear him in the space, you can almost feel like this is someone shouting into this empty landscape. All the details really help carry this over. He can move his voice and hit the note as the guitar hits. So there's that nice unison of it. But again, with every four bars, it's still very ploddy and the bass still has enough time to just keep you walking forwards. But there's just that nice milestone as you go through the story. And so it's pleasing, but also in a way which is still downtrodden and uncomfortable and just colours the story in an appropriate way. When we get to the chorus with the who's going to win the war, with the military style drumming through it, suddenly you get that slightly jingoistic feeling, but it's not a call to action who's going to win the war. It's almost like a does it matter at this point? How much has been lost for someone to feel like this is a win? So again, it feels like a protest song with a lot of imagination to it. Kind of sarcasm or, you know, that kind of black humor rather than just coming at it directly in the same way that, say, like Urban Gorilla did. This is what I like more about Hawkwind, when they can really digest it and come through with this not angry but disappointed work. And I think this is just them at their most creative again when they do this. Even the lead guitar stops being like a mile a minute celebration, like you said, and becomes this one or two notes to just pick out further feelings of desolation as these ringing, shrieking notes fade into nothing. You just get this feeling like this could be the story of someone who's walked through a battle when everything's finished, like that kind of Siegfried Sassoon kind of poem about like when two armies go over the top and there's the fight, but then after the fight there's just chaos. And this feels like a snapshot of that kind of thing. It's kind of like another companion piece to Damnation Alley and Uncle Sam's on Mars in that way. But instead of talking about the exuberance of surviving this that they had before with Damnation Alley, this is looking at it in the other way. This is looking at all the people who didn't make it and the desolation and destruction, and more maybe like Children of the Sun, that idea of going back to the reality of this rather than the sci-fi idea of what it means to look at this. So it feels very performative. For me, it kind of felt like it could be on the War of the Worlds album. It could have fitted into that story quite nicely. And then the last minute dissolves into this rather sublime instrumental as we're left to think about everything that's been told to us, which Hawkwind have done before several times, which I really like when they give us enough time to actually digest things rather than just quickly move on to the next things. Yeah, for me, this is a definite highlight of the album.
A couple of brilliant things you picked up on there. I can totally see this on War of the Worlds around side four in the Dead London part when it's all over. And while you were talking, it called back to me. I've been listening to, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and some of them are military history. There's a brilliant one called Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, and he was doing this six-hour show about the history of nuclear war. And he was talking to people, and he'd read some bits from books. And looking back to the 50s and 60s, particularly in the 60s and then the early 70s, where the US apparently, their first ever nuclear military strategy was, at the first sign of trouble, launch everything. And that was the one and only option in the book.
Mm.
So they're coming up with more, and they're having arguments internally about the use of nuclear weapons and what you can do. And they have the RAND Corporation, who are kind of doing it all numerically in a very kind of cold way. And there was a quote somebody talked about, and I cannot remember the names of these people, but somebody in the US government talked to somebody in the military saying, you know, we'll all die. What have you got then? And the response from the military guy was, if at the end of this, there are two Americans alive and one Soviet, we won. And it's a kind of mentality, it's hard to get your head around, but it's a mentality that seems to be part of the fabric of this song. I actually very much prefer this almost resigned vocal. I've listened to, particularly after the New Year special, to the different versions of this. I actually think that vocally, it matches the song for him to sing it in this very downbeat, more resigned, somber tone. That really works for me. And I much prefer this song now to how I felt about it back in the day. Maybe that's because I have so much more context for it in retrospect. Like, I lived through that 1980s Cold War period.
Mm.
But weirdly, that feels much more dangerous to me now than it did at the time, because at the time, it was just a fact of life. And if I'd been older, maybe I would have recognized the terrifying nature of it, which Hawkwind obviously did. But yeah, I find it very evocative now, and a great track that I really listen to quite intensely when it comes on.
If you took this track out of this album, it would be almost the least Hawkwind album I've heard in a while. So it's nice to have this one here as a feeling that the band is still there and Calvert's departure did not remove all of that spirit. This being in here is I think, quite vitally important to the quality of this entire thing.
Absolutely. Bit of a tone change now as we go into a track which in football terms would be what happens when you give the ball to the Galacticos and just watch them play. This is the crazed freak out that is Space Chase, which apparently is the track that Simon King just couldn't get to grips with in the state that he was in at the time. And Ginger Baker just sat down and nailed.
I can see why. I mean, it's demanding. The first time I heard this track, I didn't know what it was called. And when I looked at my phone, it was called Space Chase. I was like, that is the most appropriate name for this. I love that. It feels like it could be a soundtrack to a chase in a film, or actually because of that bleepy bloopy stuff at the start that sounds like an old arcade game, for the second time in this album, it feels like it could be an arcade game reference. Again, I feel like this is Hawkwind being very musically confident in a way that I haven't ever really heard them be like that before. It's got a riff that just carries the whole track. I feel like some of that special effects kind of like swazzle, like some of the early Hawkwind albums, including the very first one. I feel like that's back a little bit in this, which I really like. And the drums are so good at changing the feel of this. They go from this clattering intensity to suddenly switching up and doing that kick snare, along with the riff, which just then completely changes for a second how you think about the track. And then it's back into the more intense stuff. And again, it's these flares and these touches that just make you feel like Hawkwind have the ability now to explore a musical idea as much as a thought, to go from this spacey weightlessness to deep and intense at a moment's notice, makes this track feel like a real event. Probably more to my taste than Levitation in terms of what they're doing, taking you through that journey, but no less intense. And for me, no less fun. I always finish this track with a big smile on my face, even if Who's Gonna Win the War is trying to wipe it off me. This puts it back on and becomes a very enjoyable track. I feel like Space Chase really knocks out of the park what World of Tears set up a few tracks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a joy to listen to. I particularly love the point in the track where Tim Blake comes in with the big keyboard arpeggiators. It just goes off on one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there you go, Tim, run with that. And yeah, it just brings a huge smile. They seem to be having a great time playing this. It's a bit of a joy. As you say, there's not huge amounts to say, really, other than the fact that the playing is just incredible from everybody concerned. And, you know, don't want to sound too critical of Simon King here with this. The man was obviously going through a pretty bad time. What a fantastic servant to Hawkwind he was. But totally, Ginger Baker does something different in Hawkwind. It's not a question of doing what Simon King did and doing it better. It's different to what Simon King did. Simon apparently made one or two attempts to get back into drumming. Didn't really happen. Cleaned his life up, led a normal life, was very, very happy. So, you know, good end to the story for him. But I don't feel that this track would be anything like what it is with any other drummer than Ginger Baker playing it. But there is definitely such a joy to both Hugh and Tim's playing in this track. So it's always a big smile to my face whenever this one comes on.
For sure. And I know ages ago we were talking around how Hawkwind reconciled the synth vibe with the rock vibe and how it comes together. When you start to get really great musicians, it almost becomes an eventuality. It just feels like this is somewhere where they should get to. And it's just done so well and so nicely. This feels weirdly, in a way, like more Hawkwind, even though there isn't the story to it. We've heard these instrumentals before, but done in this super intense way. I like the playful name. I just like the fact that this is them going, we're having fun with this. You can have fun with this. Let's all have fun with this. And you feel like, I'm gonna. Thanks.
Yep, exactly. Does the job very well. And then mood change again as we get to the fifth second of Forever from the film. I trust you know which film this is from. The answer is?
The answer is there isn't one.
There isn't one is the correct answer.
Which took way too long for me to discover that. So thanks, Hawkwind, again, and your slightly fan-hating sense of humour that you've employed once again.
And there is a reference here, of course, on Space Ritual. There is the track 10 Seconds of Forever, which is kind of one of the spoken word tracks. This, the fifth of those 10 seconds. And yeah, very different with that classical guitar intro and then onward from there.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I did get that reference, the fifth second of Forever, from the 10 seconds of Forever. It was then from the film that I was like, okay, what's that all about? And then had a look and couldn't find anything. And then assuming that it was a joke. The intro kind of reminded me of Jack of Shadows in a way, with that same flamenco vibe to it. It felt a bit folktale-y again, but then it switches up into something way more familiar. The treatment of the vocals reminds me of Lord of Light, because I feel like it's got that kind of processing and that strange distortion through it that makes the voice flutter and feel like it's even further away than before. So I quite like that. It was nice to hear it back again. It made this track feel more familiar, a little bit more like some of the earlier albums, like the Do-Re-Mi's. It felt a bit more like we'd gone back there a bit, maybe because we could with the artists that we're now working with. I feel like the track's over a lot sooner than I thought it was going to be. I feel like as soon as it gets going, it drops back to the flamenco style and it's out. I like the bit in the middle. I personally find the flamenco bits are perfectly fine, but they're not so good that I particularly love them. It's a difficult track for me to fully enjoy, but there are bits of it which I definitely do like with all that vocal processing.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because there are bits about this song that I really like, but it's structured in a very strange way. I quite like that classical guitar intro, works quite well for me, and then into the track. And then that middle bit, like you, I love that. And then as you're just thinking, great, I've got like a vocal melody and a riff here and I really like it. You're thinking you're going to get several verses of that and you don't. You get it once, which is great that you get it once, but you're thinking it'd be brilliant if you could get it again. And then it goes back to finish with the classical guitaring. I quite liked it at the beginning, but I don't need it to bookend the track. I'd rather they just did something more with the middle bit of the track and they broke that out into a full song of its own because I really liked that bit. So it's not that I dislike the track because I quite like the intro. I just only want it as an intro. And I like the middle bit, but I want more of that. And then I wouldn't mind the ending, but I only like it at the start. So I like all the bits. I just wish they hadn't done it in the order that they've done it and in the way that they've done it. It's slightly annoying when you've got something that's as good as that middle bit is, and then you just let it go so easily.
Yeah, it kind of feels like they weren't as confident in it as we are listening to it, maybe somehow. It just feels like it's there, but yeah, I feel like the arrangement is surprising.
Yeah, very much so. Big one to end, Dust of Time.
The way that this track is fitted into the album, the way it plays, this is a bit like Psychosis going into World of Tears. When I first heard it, when I had my phone in my pocket and I wasn't paying attention, you get the outro of Fifth Second, which is the guitar, and then it goes straight into Dust of Time. So I thought that that was the second part of the Fifth Second Forever. And I was like, oh, this is picked up. This is good. And no, it's a completely different track. But for me, the Fifth Second of Forever and Dust of Time actually go together quite nicely in a kind of brainstorm Golden Void kind of way. The way that they treat them, it feels like they're two tracks that go nicely together and complete a full thought.
I like the idea that actually that bit of acoustic guitar is the introduction for both tracks. They liked it so much as the introduction for one track that they just used it again as the introduction for Dust of Time.
Exactly. Dust of Time breaks into one of the best riffs that they've made, I think. There's something super nice about it. Just big and atmospheric. There's like some nice reverb or processing on the guitar, which sounds great. I love the spacey wistfulness of it. I love the interplay between the bass and the lead. That's absolutely fantastically put together. Then the lyrics come in and they remind me a bit of Death Trap in the way that they're assembled. Like ending on a lot of shuns, a lot of ins, a lot of ings, that kind of thing. Like standing on the valley of all creation, which I could then change to sounds like Jesus Christ leaving for the station. You know, the way it just works somehow, I feel like there's something that's very reminiscent of that, which I like. And the track happily glides along for like 2 minutes or so. And then there's this strange switch for me, just as I'm getting into it. It's not Clown Car, but the voice of the synth that comes in just for like a bar sounds quite carnival-y or something to me, which always throws me out of the groove. I'm not a big fan of that at all when I like the rest of it. The bass is just great, big round notes. The main riff is giving me all this atmosphere. And then you have this kind of like do-do-do-do-do-do-do over it. And I'm like, oh, why did you do that? That's really annoying. And then it's gone and we're into the breakdown, which feels safe and comforting and kind of welcomes back the Hawkwind piano, which is always a nice to see an old friend return for the last track. And we rise back into the main riff and the breakdown is really sublime and we come back out again and we're out. Just for me, I have to try and reconcile whether or not that little carnival bit ruins the track for me or not, because I hate that it's there, but I love the rest of the track so much. I also feel like this track ends in a slightly unsatisfying way. I would have drawn it out for a little longer or something. I feel like I'm dumped out of the album a little bit faster than I wanted at the end of everything.
It's interesting. That middle bit resurfaces on an album called Zones, which is like a collection of live and odds and bits and things, as a track in its own right called The Island. But it's that middle section. And it used to spin me out completely because I didn't listen to Levitation that much. And I didn't listen to Zones that much. So I'd put Zones on and I'd hear this track and I'd be thinking, I thought that was on a different album. I could have sworn it was on another album. But then I couldn't remember where it was. And then I'd listen to it on Levitation and I'd go, hang on, that's the same thing. But what was it? What album is it on? Right? Because it's a different name. So it's not like you can go through the track listings of the albums and pick out, oh, Dust of Time is on both, because it's not. It's called something different. And that used to really spin me out. It used to annoy me every time I heard it. I'd think, oh, I've heard that somewhere else. Where is it? But I couldn't picture. I couldn't remember where. But like you, I love the riff. It's a beautiful one. And again, the lyrics feel really Hawkwindy. I don't have the reaction to the middle section like you do. To me, the fact that it is surfaces as a track in its own right means it kind of is a track in its own right. But I don't kind of object to it so much. The ending to me is odd because the final chord of the whole song does not sound like the way a final chord of a song should feel. I think there is something else going to happen. So weirdly, the way the song ends, I don't get closure on the album.
That's what I mean by feeling like I feel dumped out.
Exactly. It's really annoying. It's like somebody taking your last piece of chocolate and you don't get closure on the bar. You have to go and buy another one just to have the last bit.
When I was a kid, we used to tape albums off each other and sometimes you just run out of tape before the end of the album or something. You know, it just cuts and you're like, damn, I missed that last bit. It feels like they just did that, but they did it to their own album rather than someone trying to dub it off.
It's really weird. And just they only needed another 5 seconds to find a different chord to end it on. It would be fine. When I'm streaming it, I actually just let it play to hear Valium 10, which obviously does not fit the tone of the album at all. But which at least
gives you something to finish on.
But yes, I've always been ready for the next bit of the song and then kind of realized, being disappointedly, that it doesn't come. So that was the music of Levitation. But as we all know, the music is only part of the story with Hawkwind. Let's take a look at that album cover. And as it was with Astounding Sounds, there's actually two artists, one doing the front, one doing the back. Linda Curry did the front cover of Levitation. Try as I might, I could find no details on Linda Curry other than it is the name of the person who did the front of this album. The back, on the other hand, is done by Philip Tonkin, who we know from PXR5. We also did tweet out Philip Tonkin's current website with all of his art on it, so he's a little bit more of a known quantity to us. So Matt, what do you make of this album cover?
It's a bit of a puzzle because it seems to be photorealistic up to a point, but then there is a spaceship in it, which I'm assuming is the Hawkwind because it has Hawkwind written on it. It has a very kind of hawky face, which I feel like it's the first time we've ever seen the idea of the ship be actually shown as a kind of bird, which is fine. But again, it's slightly surprising in a way, because I always thought that Hawkwind was slightly figurative, but I feel like there's a very birdy face with a kind of birdy beak and a kind of glaring eye at the very front of it. It looks like it's done with some kind of spray pen, maybe, but the mountains below it look like they might be real, at least from the imagery that I could find.
The spaceship isn't my favorite spaceship I've seen on the cover of a Hawkwind album and looks a little flat. And then there is the projection from the spaceship onto the mountains. Does look like smack bang in the middle of the triangle there is an eye, which would give it a certain Illuminati feel. But I'm not entirely sure. There's sometimes I see it and I see this eye, and sometimes I see it and it's not.
No, I see it.
You do see it. That's good.
It looks like the Oculus, the all-seeing eye, which is in the American dollar bill sign.
Yes, that's the one.
For me, the whole thing is also a bit of a perspectival nightmare. The ship is coming in towards us a little bit, but is projecting down onto a slanted rock, but the eye is then also tilting away from us. I feel like it should do something, like if I move it slightly, it'll correct itself or something will happen.
Yeah, the circle is perfect, as opposed to being mapped to the terrain. I find it slightly unsatisfying as Hawkwind covers go, because it's kind of just looks like it's been put together rather than being a piece of art, which so many of the other covers have been.
I completely agree. I feel like the two things which are the most interesting things, the projection and the ship, have both somehow been relegated off to the centres. You know, like you've got the ship in the top corner, so you're kind of seeing it, but also not. And also what it's projecting is not even dead centre. Nothing for me is arranged with any feeling of aesthetics in any way. It feels very odd. And I guess considering that we've been raised on a diet of Barney, and even things like Philip Tonkin's last album cover, which was very weird in a kind of like wiggly plug vision of whatever the hell, at least it had some kind of like resolution to it, where I feel like even the fact that Hawkwind Levitation is just shoved in the corner with the ship, you know, like it feels like the first draft of something, and instead of then giving notes, they went, yeah, that'll do, which is odd considering the amount of attention to detail that the musicians put into the work. This is the first time I feel like Hawkwind have shown less attention to detail, which possibly the exception of the Live 79 cover, which is still giving me a migraine whenever I think about it.
Yeah, indeed. It looks like something that maybe they weren't as directly involved with as they have been in the past, where people kind of from the Hawkwind collective have been involved in these things. Certainly the Live 79 cover, which, as you say, is something of a visual nightmare. The back cover, on the other hand, is friend Philip Tonkin from PXR5. And that's actually quite a striking image with this kind of various different aspects of it, including the triangle from the projection. But there's a lot going on in this image.
Yeah, it's weird, though. It feels like if Hawkwind was ever to do some kind of Calypso cover version of their own work, this would be a good front cover. It's not a hawk to me, it's a parrot. And it looks like there's water, and the kind of Oculus-y eye is shown as an almost sandcastle. And Hawkwind is written in this jivey font. Like, I feel like I need a rum and coke in order to really appreciate this whole back cover. I don't know what's going on. It has nothing to do with what I'm hearing when I look at it. I honestly thought that Philip was taking the piss when I saw this. I feel like the front, which I don't particularly jive with, is at least somehow more appropriate with the idea of a ship and a strange projection and just something. But no, the back is all kinds of weird, and I do not understand that at all.
So the front cover is slightly unsatisfying and the back cover is utterly confusing. So for the first time, really, we've got a cover that we're just not really in tune with. And considering the attention to detail and the pristine nature of the music on this album, you wonder whether the band have just really focused on that and really just left the album cover to the label, which I think is what happened with Live 79. Hard to tell in this case, but not quite the glory days of the Bubbles covers and even the Hypnosis cover for Quark, Strangeness and Charm. So we're left a little flat, it's fair to say.
The only thing which I would be intrigued about is the fact that this eye triangle is in both. So I do wonder whether or not someone picked that out of all the things that Hawkwind had known for and gave that as a brief and said, work around that. And then whatever they got back, they were like, yeah, that'll do. I don't know, but it's interesting that that is the one thing that puts the two together. I mean, like, they're so different, but the fact that that is the one icon that links the two, it does feel like maybe there was some brief somewhere that the artists were given.
No, that's totally fair. And, you know, you can imagine that they both submitted what they thought was a front cover, and then the band just chose to go with one, or the label chose to go with one and put the other one on the back. It's kind of hard to say, but certainly it makes the album less of a kind of multimedia package than we've been used to. Orquin covers have been such an integral part of the overall package, I think. Even with PXR5, there was something in there that connected the two together. This one is very much just packaging for the music.
You know, you were talking about Virgin and before, who sometimes would just grab whatever they bought, squish it together and reissue it, and would probably make some kind of new thing that they didn't care about. This feels like the reissue artwork, but it's not. It's the real one. This is genuinely odd compared to everything else. Like, even the first album, that cover, I've said looks like a child's drawing or something. I don't understand why mystical alligators are trying to attack me. I think that album cover art is probably better than this, just for the lack of feeling of cohesion. You're right, it does feel corporate somehow. It does feel like someone who has never bothered to understand what Hawkwind is about has grabbed the first three things that someone told them about them and just made a thing. And, you know, like working in the communication and advertising industry, I feel like I can almost see that in this. You know, you can tell when something's done, not cynically, but just like lazily, like we need to get it done. Here's 500 quid. Will you just like get it done for us? And it does feel like a little bit of that. And I feel like I'm maybe being overly mean if there is a legit reason for this, but it does look like the kind of thing that you might put together if you didn't care that much.
It wouldn't worry me, and it doesn't worry me that much, but it would worry me less if Hawkwind as a band didn't seem to care so much about the artwork and art in general and album covers and visuals. They're such a visual band. You know, other bands that I like, I don't bother with the covers that much. They don't mean much to me. But Hawkwind are a bit different, and this one doesn't really work, and the back cover wouldn't have made a good front cover either. So, yeah, it's a little bit by the numbers, really. Serviceable, but no more than that. So good job that the music's decent, really.
100%. So I'm wondering whether or not because of that, we can intuit that someone who left the band cared about that more than maybe Brock himself, who is the through line on this. Again, I don't know what the rest of the 80s album covers have in store for us. So I'm only looking at that based on this. But considering so many people have gone, including someone like Calvert, who I was wondering might have been someone who had a better relationship with someone like Barney or someone who was looking at this from a more holistic point of view. I feel like Brock is a definite musician, but whether or not he's appreciated the whole audiovisual thing and whether or not he's sometimes seen that as something which has been more of a hindrance to his vision, maybe, I'm not sure, by the fact he's thrown albums out of the window and that kind of thing. Maybe he hasn't felt that so much. But that, again, that's purely a supposition based on this. I don't know. But just looking at it right now, that's kind of the conclusion that I come to.
It's an interesting one. It's probably a question maybe for Joe or Ian, one of our authors out there, because you could make a case that certainly Bob Calvert and Barney Bubbles were pretty close. And we're talking about, you know, 25 years on and that whole pan transcendental industries story and all the rest of it. And maybe Nick Turner back in the day was more part of that kind of collective scene. Maybe Brock was. Maybe this was just a bit of a one-off on that scene and maybe Bronze had something to do with it. But yeah, it'd be interesting to know. We're always interested, of course, to think about how our feelings about this music coincide or not with wider Hawkwind fans thinking about this music. And our litmus test for that, because you need some form of reference, we actually have the Elric Newby book, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Facebook Top 40 Albums, which is, as I'm sure you'll remember, a bit of a poll of a particular Hawkwind Facebook group that just put all of the albums in order from a whole load of polls that he ran, and as such, provides us with a useful reference to see where this one lands. And this one lands pretty well, Matt. If we're just doing the studio albums, then this is actually at number 3, after Warrior on the Edge of Time at 1 and Quark, Strangeness and Charm at number 2. Levitation comes in number 3 for the bronze medal.
How appropriate. That's interesting to me because I was over the holiday, I was going through the list that we'd currently made, trying to figure out what was left to fill and when we would fill it. So the fact that this has come in at number 3 is interesting. I feel like it makes sense, at least again from what I've heard, the inclusion of such, as you said, virtuoso musicians is almost like a special edition of Hawkwind, maybe. And considering that people leave afterwards, I guess Hawkwind goes a little bit, quote unquote, back to normal, maybe. I'm also glad as well, considering that 10 albums in and a whole decade of music, that they are still creating things that bewitch fans. And as you talked about before with the Live 79, that with this band, it kind of re-galvanized that for them. And even the Silver Machine on Live 79, it's infuriating that they just blow it up halfway through. But the little solo noodle that they do before it goes into the vocal is one of the most exciting things that I'd heard out of Hawkwind for a while. You know, just that feeling of energy. And that did make me feel like, despite everything we've heard, despite things falling apart, people leaving, people trying to do solo projects and it falling apart, no one knows what's going on. The fact that they can still go on a stage and just hammer that kind of thing out, it made me feel like everything will be all right in the end. So to come out of all of that and produce this, it makes me feel like I'm rooting for them, you know, even in the 80s.
Yeah.
I feel very gratified that they've been able to do that. You know, I'm with them. I want them to do well, and they have.
And again, those top three positions are filled by albums which could not be much more different from each other. So that's pretty good. It's time for us to conclude on Levitation. What are your closing thoughts here, Matt?
My concluding thoughts, I guess, given everything I know, is that bands, like amazing bands, have lasted way less than Hawkwind in terms of how long they can stand each other or do things before they go and do other stuff. So to do anything for 10 years and then still be able to reinvent yourself, as we talked about at the end of your special, the only constant is change for Hawkwind. To change it up in a way where it's actually changing it in terms of increasing the quality of the music on purpose by bringing these people in is something that you wouldn't expect, because you feel like, you know, most bands get together when they are good and progress from there. Where Hawkwind did it slightly differently by the busk style and the jam style. It was very much free-for-all-y kind of stuff in the 70s. And it feels like almost in a way in the 80s, you can't get away with that so much. Like, I can't really think of a band which came out of the 80s right now off the top of my head in a kind of more scuffly kind of weird way that wasn't super underground. I mean, everything is very produced. Everyone is looking at studio work. Everyone is looking at, like, you know, this is the age of the music video. And you look at all the bands that, even the bands that you mentioned that have been in the 70s are changing sound or adapting to this new way that people want to consume music and entertainment. So the fact that Hawkwind can rise to that is really interesting. And I think it comes out really well in this album. And to listen to this has been really enjoyable in a different way, in a way where I can really appreciate the musicality. So I feel revitalized coming into season two for us, even just as people who have chosen to listen to and talk about this. I was not worried, but maybe slightly concerned about, like, can we come back to this? Like, you know, if this album was a dud, coming in for season two would have been such hard work. And it hasn't been, because there's been a lot to talk about again because of the energy in this album. So my thoughts right now is that I'm hoping that they can take some of this newness that they've got and throw it out into the rest of the decade that we're going to go through. Even if people have left, hopefully some of that has been incorporated into the essence of what the band is. And the fact that we have things like Who's Going to Win the War mixed with things like Space Chase makes me feel like they haven't lost themselves, but they have a little bit more to offer now. And like I said before at the beginning, I just hope that they don't start to sound like a band, because I don't want them to sound like a band. I want them to sound like themselves, you know? So I'm excited. I'm intrigued and I'm optimistic.
That's a good place to be. It really is interesting that after several years without being a band in the studio recording a new album, i.e. the gap between this and PXR 5, reconstituting a new lineup, really kind of coming out swinging with this. But it's interesting, as you say, the 80s feels like such a decade of production. And if anybody had said in the 80s, when production kind of went digital, who was one of the first bands to completely digitally record their album? I'm not sure you'd think of Hawkwind, but that just is a testament to how on it they are with regard to taking up new ideas and new technologies. Even when we did the Somnia thing, we talked about that. So, yep, definitely a good one for me. Most of the albums I really enjoy listening to, they really take me back, but they really engage me with the music again. But by the time we get to actually record the episode, I'm kind of getting excited about the next one, and I'm kind of ready to move on to the next album. There's been a couple where it's been a real wrench to get to recording, because I know I won't listen to Levitation quite as much now, because you've got to move on. You can't keep in the zone of that album. You've got to get your head into the new space and the new one. And with Quark, I was slightly mourning the loss of Quark when we had to move on past it, because I was quite excited about playing it every time. And I've reached that point with Levitation, which is not a point I was with Levitation when I first got it, basically, and where I'd been with it up to now. But it's definitely one that'll stay with me and made a bit of a lasting impression. So it's definitely, as you say, been a great one to come back into season two with. We have to pick some tracks now, Matt, for the playlists. And firstly, your pick for the master playlist, the track.
This is actually really difficult, but I want to go with Space Chase. I want to go with something that feels really new, fresh, different, vibrant, energetic. All these things which I still like about Hawkwind, for me, elevated up to an incredible level. The drums, the interplay between lead and bass, all the things about it. It's amazing it's only like 3 minutes long. I can't believe it, because it always feels longer to me. But there's just an energy and fun to it, which, given just the things that we picked before from PXR5 and 25 years, they're super heavy, big things. And I think if Joe hadn't talked about who's going to win the war, I would probably have gone for that. But I feel like there's something nice about the fact that I've been offered up this different face of Hawkwind for this, to be able to put it in and to kick off the decade with this. I feel good about that decision.
That's an excellent pick, because I think of the whole album, this is the track that best encapsulates what this album stands for. So totally with you on that. And on the Hawkbench Sessions playlist, which we're obviously creating a brand new one starting with this episode, what will join Space Chase?
It's going to be Dust of Time. I like the riff of that. It's still super infectious. And for me, the fact that, like I said, can I bring myself to like this track despite the fact that there's a very annoying little like trill thing that's in there for a second? After listening to this for a long time, I've decided that I definitely can. I like the vibe of this. I do think the lead riff is really atmospheric. Again, the interplay of all the instruments are great. I wanted to get something with a lyric in there because I felt like that's important. But I do like the poetry that does exist in Dust of Time. And I think that given that we've lost some of the poets of Hawkwind, a glimpse caught in a sigh in the way that it's delivered feels like Hawkwind is still finding ways to be very evocative with their words. And it's the one which is delivered without the shout, without the vocals having to make up for the power of the instruments. And I think that's because the instruments do pare it down a bit, but the processing and the delivery is still really nice. The interplay between the vocals and the main riff, I find very, very evocative. It has a really nice vibe to it. So I do think that Dust of Time has something which I haven't quite heard before, but again, has various elements that have been placed in a way which really gels with me. With that, I'd like to give an honorable mention to Levitation and World of Tears and Who's Gonna Win the War. I wasn't expecting this album to be such a hard pick, because I feel like the other albums, they had some good stuff, but there were a few where you just like that one. And honestly, all of this might be I'm not sure this is the right word, but for me, this might be one of the most perfect albums that Hawkwind have done, in terms of there's way less stuff which they do which really annoys me, Psychosis notwithstanding.
Yeah, it's very consistent. Yeah, it's very, very consistent. It's not one where you build up to the big track and then when you've done the big track, everything else is a bit of a step back. Totally agree. So Dust of Time will join Space Chase on the Hawkbin Sessions playlist. I just hope when I play this particular Hawkbin Sessions playlist on Shuffle, Dust of Time isn't the last track, because there needs to be something after it so that I can get closure on the playlist. And where can people get these playlists, Matt?
These playlists can be found on Spotify, Andy. If you check out Hawk Binge on Spotify, then we should come up. I think we're one of the only things that come up. You can find our master playlist, which has everything from the 70s and now will roll into the 80s in a all-consuming mega playlist. The first three sessions playlists are on there right now, and number four will be up soon after.
Outstanding. And as you would have gathered from the postbag at the top of the show, we love hearing from all of you, whether those are huge long emails or one-liners on the YouTube channel or on Twitter and Instagram. We're always really happy to read what these things mean to you and how the music affects you and how you're getting on with Hawk Binge generally. And Matt, where can people get in touch with us to do that?
Well, we are at Hawk Binge on both Instagram and Twitter. And if you find us on YouTube by searching Hawk Binge, we should come up again. We are going for that 100 subscriber count. And as soon as we get 100 subscribers, you will be able to find us at YouTube/Hawk Binge. So if you are not subscribed and feel like helping us with that, we would massively appreciate it. If you want to send us anything more long form, our email address is podcast@hawkbinge.space.
Outstanding. And with that, I'm going to leave the last word on levitation to Mr. Joe Banks as we say goodbye to readings from his book, as this is as far as he gets in the Hawkwind story. We will miss reading from this marvelous book, Hawkwind: Days of the Underground, Radical Escapism in the Age of Paranoia. But that does not necessarily mean that we will not hear from Joe again. I'm sure there will be reasons that we can get Joe back on the pod. And this is what Joe has to say about levitation. With their 10th studio album and first for the 80s, it's worth reflecting on how far Hawkwind have come and how much they've stayed the same. One of the first LPs to be recorded digitally and proudly described as a headphones album, Levitation showcases a modern rock band confidently integrating the latest technology into their sound. Sonically, it's a world away from the foggy caveman psych of their debut. Yet most songs are still based around Brock's blocky guitar riffs and robotic vocal melodies, while the band continue to be thematically and visually defined by science fiction. There's still no other band quite like Hawkwind. Over the past decade, they've established elements of psychedelia, prog, krautrock, punk and metal to create a subgenre with a membership of one. This uniqueness will be key to their ongoing success, or at least survival, but is also a factor in their increasing estrangement from mainstream rock culture. Thank you, Joe. We bid you farewell. And as for us, where do we go next? Well, I'm afraid I fear the imminent signs of sonic destruction. Do not panic. Think only of yourselves.
Cells. 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 Cells.